Chapter 18. I went straight to bed and slept fitfully, but at least there were no strange nightmares or satanic visions, just restless turning around in my bunk, drifting in and out. I'd been exhausted after that midnight mission, so it was well past midday when I rose. I immediately went for a long PT session, treadmill, stretching, weights. I'd hoped that the familiar routine and working my body would ease my sense of dread and anxiety. But not today. My subconscious mind knew I was trying to distract it and was having none of that nonsense. After a shower and food, I dealt with my messages on the wall screen in my rooms and waited for an invitation to that planning meeting Jorgen had mentioned. Always before, I'd just shown up to meetings. Jorgen didn't always send me a specific invitation because my attendance was expected. And so, as the time approached, I didn't know for certain if I had been excluded. I leaned back in my bunk, scratching Doomslug, who had her own little bed beside mine. She sensed my mood and didn't say anything. Knowing Hesho, he was probably standing guard outside my door. He'd taken to doing that most days, part of his self-imposed duty as the masked exile bodyguard. I could have chatted with him, but I didn't want to talk to anyone. I wanted to be alone. When you're in that kind of mood, it's awkward to have friends who can literally pop inside your head. "Hey," Embot said, "something is up with the Delvers. They're growing agitated." "Are you in danger?" I asked. "Probably. But I've been in danger the entire time, so who knows? They'll destroy me if they can, but they're obviously afraid of you. Maybe even of me, a little. Wish I knew why." "I know some of it," I said, lying in my bunk, staring at the ceiling. "After you sacrificed yourself and let me escape into the light burst, they tried to, I don't know, crush me, overwhelm me, shred my soul. Combining with Chet, though, showed me something. He was in pain, and my life experience allowed him to overcome it. In turn, I needed an awareness of the nowhere and the Delvers, which he could provide. So when the Delvers touched me, they were subjected to pain." "That pain," Embot said, "that's their weakness. They fled into the lightburst to escape the pain of loss, right?" As the Delvers had evolved from an AI to a person, they'd been unable to cope with the death of a man they'd loved. They'd sealed away their memories and found refuge where time had no meaning, where they would never have to grow, never again have to suffer the pain of losing something or someone they loved, where nothing would ever change. Except when people from the somewhere passed through. Except when cytonics or slugs opened pathways to our dimension, where time, space, and change were inevitable parts of life. It hurt them. When they tried to destroy me, that required coming in contact with me, I explained. That hurt them too much, because I'm part of the somewhere, I think.
"More than that, I'd guess," Embot said. "They hid their memories away, but didn't eliminate them entirely. You, knowing their secrets, cuts through their layers of protections and exposes that pain again. When you touched them, you ripped away their masks, so to speak, bringing their memories to the forefront of their awareness again."
Chet leaped at that statement.
"That is key," he thought.
"So they could feel my ability to understand what they were. That was painful to them."
"You knew what they were hiding," Embot said. "They couldn't pretend when you were there. You forced them to remember, and that memory would hurt them too much to bear. They had to pull back."
"So all we need to do now," I said, "is find a way to expose the Delvers fully to their pain, remove the barrier they've put in place to hold back their memories. If we do that..."
"It will destroy them," Embot said. "Because in the nowhere, nothing changes. If you afflict them with that immense pain, then leave, they'll never escape it. They'll be trapped forever, unable to do anything, except perhaps cease to exist."
Chet, inside my soul, felt sorrow at that. What did I feel? Resignation? I had worked so hard to protect the workers at the supply depots, even though they were on the other side. What did I feel about the Delvers? It was, I decided, too complicated to sort out. Without Chet, I'd have had no qualms, but he gave me a different perspective. That sounds terrible, I said.
Yes, but it's a plan, finally, Embot said. Some way, at long last, of dealing with them, maybe permanently. Scud, Spencer, it feels good to have a plan.
Well, I often have plans, I said. That's not the problem. The problem is that I don't often give them enough time, or give others a chance to weigh in.
So,
we take it slowly, in this instance, I said, and don't try anything until we've thought it through and done more research. You think you can sneak in among them and find out if our theory is right? Maybe see if you can spot a way to restore their pain to them?
Of course. I'm not just a ghost. I'm a stealth ghost. I can do it. I'll find the answers.
Good.
And Spencer, once we do this, once we find out how to defeat the Delvers and keep the superiority from destroying Detritus, then we get what we want. That's how it is in the stories, right?
Yeah, I lied. Yeah. That's what happens in the stories, Embot.
Good,
he said, his voice fading. His withdrawal left me alone again, as I'd wanted. But that meant I went back to stewing about the meeting. Should I have gone? What did staying here accomplish? Was waiting for an invitation mature or petulant? I found myself reaching out with my senses, not on purpose, just kind of as an extension of my worries, and even my growing loneliness. So I shouldn't have been surprised by what happened next. Braid appeared in my room, a phantom, cytonic projection, her arms folded, her uniform crisp. Before, I'd been able to hide from her, but the way my soul vibrated, resonating with the Delver, had changed that. I didn't have nearly as much control now.
Scrud, Braid said to me. You have to be so loud. We're trying to figure out the best way to murder you all.
You're scared, I snapped back at her. You didn't expect us to cut you off from your resources like we did. Now you're desperate.
That was a cute trick, she admitted.
I climbed out of bed and circled Braid, and she circled me, prowling warriors assessing each other. My hand trembled with the desire to grab the knife strapped to my leg and lunge for her. It wouldn't have done any good. The blades we fought with weren't of steel. And unfortunately, she had proven stronger than I was at that sort of thing, even if I did have a Delver powering my soul.
I did want to say thank you, Braid finally said.
For
pushing Winzik and his generals into a corner, she said. They were so determined to fight a slow, wasting war. Now they'll take the better path. A final grand confrontation. Our own Agincourt or Waterloo.
She strolled around me again.
I should have known, should have seen what you were from the start. No Erdale would have had your bloodthirst, your willpower. Don't tell me you aren't excited for a final climactic confrontation.
I'd rather one that didn't cost so much, I said. Do we need to waste thousands of lives, Braid? When the outcome is inevitable and the superiority is doomed? She stepped closer and studied me for a moment, then answered.
I see, she said. You're getting weak, losing the thirst. What's causing this pacifism in you, Spencer?
You never talked like this before, I said, still rounding her. Back when we trained together, you talked about killing being a terrible thing. You said that you were a weapon trained from birth, kept captive by the superiority by necessity. You seemed afraid of yourself and what you did, not thrilled by the prospect of battle. She smiled.
Perhaps knowing you awakened something.
Or more likely, I said, you were playing a role back then. Which is why you went to Winzik so eagerly once you knew what I really was. You know, I actually thought I could get through to you,
I thought you were brainwashed.
Honest mistake, Braid said. Who would have expected a human to be so good at pretending to be what she wasn't?
Remarkable.
When you realize there were two of us doing it.
So what about this, then? I said, gesturing to her, posturing about the glory of battle. Another false face? Hoping I'll underestimate you?
More like trying to find common ground, she said, toying with a destructor holster on her hip.
I realized I knew a third Braid, the one I'd spied on from the nowhere. One who prowled like a leopard, watching Winsick with a calculating relaxation. That seemed to be her true self. Not the cowed captive, not this bloodthirsty warrior. Instead, a crafty manipulator, more companion to Winsick than slave.
Scud, no wonder she'd betrayed me. I hadn't just been messing with his plans, but hers. The battle does intrigue me, she said. Do you know how many times our ancestors tried to conquer the galaxy? How long the humans spent proving themselves?
Tyrants, I said, exactly like the superiority.
Oh, come on, Braid said, flopping down on a seat that appeared in the vision as she interacted with it. You can't have it both ways, Spencer. Either the battle is glorious and brilliant, or it's a useless waste of lives. It's getting tiresome to watch you vacillate.
I didn't rise to the jibe. I couldn't help but see even this as calculated in some way. Yes, I was a little inconsistent. I felt inconsistent. But I was figuring things out. I could love stories of courage and admire the strength of warriors without wanting to see innocent people dead. Either way, I would have absolutely no qualms about ramming a knife through Braid's eye, then twisting. Sometimes you had to feel bad pulling the trigger. Other times, a target presented herself with such utter contemptibility that guilt didn't enter into the equation. A part of me was grateful to her for making that part easy.
You want to get this over with? Braid asked me.
How?
You, she said, pointing. Me. Duel, in person, starfighter against starfighter.
What would that accomplish? I asked.
We'd find out which of us is better.
We know who's better, I said. I beat you 3 out of 4 times in the Delver maze.
What, back then? Braid asked. When you were trying to pretend you were some half-pacifist alien, and I was pretending that I wasn't so dangerous, so as to not scare the rest of you away.
Scrut, that was so annoying. I narrowed my eyes at her and didn't buy it. Yes, she'd been legitimately frustrated during our sparring. Insubordinate. She hadn't liked being there in those training sessions. She'd probably hated that assignment. What reason would she have had to hold back? None. She had every reason to bolster the reputation of human soldiers and no reason to pull punches. I was the better pilot. Though a part of me really wanted to find out for certain.
I'm not going to duel you for pride, I said. Then do it for tactical advantage, she said. I'm Winsick's strongest cytonic. You should see the pathetic collection of half-brained excuses he has otherwise. His people have spent centuries breeding the skill out of themselves, the idiots. Yes, they have the hyperdrives, but this is like refusing to oil your sidearm because you have a rifle.
An apt metaphor. I wavered.
If I kill you, Braid said, I'm denying your people their strongest weapon. If you kill me, same. Seems like we both have an interest in a good old-fashioned duel.
She narrowed her eyes.
I want it. Do you?
Yes, I whispered, realizing I did. I wanted to slice that smile off her face so badly, then nail it to my wall as a trophy. I'd lost my desire to kill indiscriminately, but that didn't mean I wasn't still me.
We meet alone, Braid said. Here.
Coordinates forcibly entered my head, like an arrow pointing the way.
Day after tomorrow, she said. 36 old Earth hours from now.
I looked at my clock. Shouldn't it be 39.5 hours instead? Then it would be high noon.
How quaint, Braid said. I won't tell my people. Whimsit gives me a long leash these days. I can sneak away. You?
I didn't respond, but she seemed to read the eagerness in my expression, for she vanished a moment later. I was left feeling uncertain. I'd just gotten us into enormous trouble by running off on my own. But if I could kill Braid, or better, capture her, then we'd be in a much stronger tactical position. I knew how much Winzik relied on her for cytonic interventions. At the very least, I knew I'd be more safe. We wouldn't have to worry about her popping in and spying on us. I wavered before making a decision. I needed someone to talk to about this. Fortunately, one of the wisest people I knew was sitting outside my door, having tea. Illustration description. Kitson profile, record DST230307. Kitson nobility. An illustration of an elaborately dressed Kitson shows it standing at 15 centimeters tall and shows the many layered robes their nobility wear, with each layer displaying a different flowing or rounded pattern. Under the robes, the Kitson wears loose, puffed pants that draw tight at the ankle. A scale drawing shows a Kitson silhouette next to a human one, with the Kitson coming to the top of the human's boot. An illustration of a ceremonial knife, both sheathed and unsheathed. It is shaped like a very short katana and has elaborate hilt wrappings. Kitson mobility platforms, with illustrations of a platform sized for a single Kitson and another sized for several. Kitson warrior. A side view and a front view of a warrior wearing more practical robes than the nobility, wearing the mask and carrying the named sword. An illustration of a sheathed katana-like sword with an interesting mechanism of unspecified purpose at the base of the blade and above the hilt. The blade is called the darting hawk that separates sinew from bone. An illustration of a ceremonial mask, which is primarily white, with simple flowing accents framing the eye holes, dropping down from the ears, and tracing a smile of exaggerated length. Chapter 19. Hesho had arranged himself cross-legged on a little carpet mat. He didn't acknowledge me as I opened the door. Instead, he carefully bowed to his teapot, then raised it and poured a single cup of tea about a quarter full. He bowed to it, then sipped it quietly until it was gone. Finished, he picked up his mask, white with red stripes in the shape of a fox's head, and affixed it back into place. It had the air of ritual about it, so I hovered behind him, waiting until he spoke.
"It is a ceremony for the Emperor," he explained. "Every Nanjan day, the head of the household pours, taking the Emperor's place. It is a representation of how everything flows from the Emperor, all comfort, all needs, all life. I had never done it before from this position. I had poured for the heads of state, but the Emperor does not drink, as he does not take from the people, only gives."
He paused.
"I used to believe that."
I settled down in the doorway as he turned around on his mat. As always, his voice was powerful and deep, a tremendous bass coming from something so small. Or maybe that was just my prejudice speaking. Why shouldn't something small produce deep sounds?
"You are troubled," he said to me.
"Am I ever not?" I said with a sigh.
"Wise," he said. "As the ocean waves are disturbed by constant turmoil, so is the life of one who lives to the full."
"I don't think I'm so much like waves, Hesho," I said, "as much as I am like a jug of something carbonated that's shaken up and down repeatedly." He chuckled at that.
"I enjoy the way you see the world spin. It makes me think that perhaps I should appreciate levity in more abundance."
Same, only in reverse. I sighed, sitting down against the doorframe and ignoring the pair of pilots from another flight who walked by. They gave us odd glances, but I was used to those.
I'm not sure I can even figure out what I want to ask at the moment. Want to talk about your problems?
It would help to receive advice, Hesho said. You are growing more thoughtful, Spencer. This is an encouraging development.
Sure. Really, I just didn't want to unload on him before I could process some more. But I would let him think I was becoming more mature.
What does one do, he said to me, when one realizes that one is a burden?
What do you mean? I asked.
I selfishly miss my old life, he said. The instant obedience of everyone around me. The ability to control destiny and make decisions. And I miss my friends, my wives, my family, my servants and colleagues, my cupbearer and my shield bearer, my eldest daughter, who is a musician of the most blissful tones. I now have only recordings.
Scud, he had a family? Families? It made sense, but sometimes it was hard to remember. I saw my friends mostly as soldiers, doing soldier things.
Then go back to them, I said. You can still fly with me if you want, but you don't have to guard my door at night, Hesho.
I appreciate it, but I would be happier if you are happy.
Ah, he said, tapping his mask. But I have taken the mask, Spin. As I told you before, this is a promise. By wearing it, I indicate to everyone that I have banished Hesho. The Emperor is no more.
Then keep the mask, I said, and go back to your wives.
I could do that, yes, and they'd probably accept me. But it would ruin too many things.
He reached into the pocket of his formal robes and took out a data pad.
The Senate is working effectively for once. They threw off the superiority while I was gone. They agreed to support this rebellion. They are debating among themselves, and strangely seem more unified now that they are no longer ruled. Plus, my children are grown and have positions of authority, most serving underneath my wives, who are far more powerful now that I'm gone. Each of the three has taken a consort.
Already? You were presumed dead for barely a few weeks.
Our unions were political, he said,
his paw resting on the screen in a way I thought was fond.
Designed to unite factions on our planet. Without me, they can return to their own families triumphant, having served the greater needs of our people. I miss them all. But each is now the most politically important member of her clan. My children gain much through the respect paid to them because of my sacrifice. My survival would have been inconvenient for everyone had I not taken the mask. It is the same story everywhere I search. My people were ready to move on. They were ready for the Emperor to vanish, but so long as I persisted, they could not. It is better for everyone that I remain isolated. Sometimes I wish I had not recovered my memories at all.
I'm sorry, Hesho, I said softly. That scudding sucks. Then I winced. Maybe pretend I said something wise instead.
I cherish wisdom, he said. Yet today, empathy helps more. Thank you. It does scudding suck. Like the dark of the moon, which can never show its face to the light and never know the kiss of the dawn.
Yeah, just like that, I said. Or when you bruise your knuckles punching Jorgen in the knee. Sucks all around because he didn't actually deserve it and now your hand hurts.
Or how the fish and the hawk can never be friends, despite having entirely different perspectives to share with one another.
Or like when you really need to scream at someone, but the only person you can find is someone nice like Rig. So after yelling, you actually feel worse.
Or how every painting will eventually degrade so that the universe is constantly losing its masterworks to inevitable decay.
Or like when you need to pee during maneuvers, but realize you forgot to hook up the flight suit catheter. Hesho chuckled. He seemed to think that one was a joke, but it really did suck. I assumed he didn't know because his ships were big enough, rather, the occupants were small enough to contain full lavatory facilities.
Thank you, he said. Smiling does help.
We could go to the firing range and blow some stuff up, I offered, if you want some real therapy.
Yes, perhaps later. You seemed concerned earlier. Can I help you in turn?
I knocked my head backward against the frame of the door, where I was still sitting, one foot up on the opposite side. Yeah, that.
I'm sorry. Would you rather not be reminded?
No, I came out looking for advice, I said. Braid wants to duel me.
Ah, you two are like a pair of celestial bodies, drawn to conflict by forces you cannot control. I am not, therefore, surprised.
I think it's a good idea, I said to him. I can beat her and remove her from Winzik's arsenal.
As I have yet to meet a pilot who can best you in a fair fight, I'm inclined to agree with that assessment, assuming we can be certain it's not a trap.
Yeah. Any idea how to do that?
Scout the area ahead of time, he said. Agree to both place an inhibitor slug before entering the region. Maybe even send in a decoy first.
Smart.
I'm simply adapting the actions taken by Jillo in The Epic of Jillo, but I appreciate your faith in me.
So we do those things, I said, except...
Jorgen?
He guessed. Yeah, Jorgen. He's going to say no. He'll worry I'm risking myself needlessly, and a duel is totally against protocol. Even though once a battle starts, we're basically just dueling each other anyway, so protocols are stupid. Wish I were an emperor.
Life is in many ways simpler when one is an absolute authority, capable of deciding whatever one wants. But there are huge drawbacks as well, Spin, to such a calling.
I suppose, I said, closing my eyes. Do you think maybe I'm like you? That everyone would be better off if I stayed away? If I flew off somewhere and never bothered them again? Then nobody would get hurt trying to keep up with me. I could just do what needed to be done, and Jorgen wouldn't get into trouble because I wouldn't be under his command. Hesho didn't reply. Hesho? I asked, cracking an eye.
I am thinking that I have burdened you with my own terrible thoughts, he admitted. That if I had not spoken of my isolation, you would not be thinking of adopting the same sensibility. That I should have remained isolated from you for your own good. That it would be for the best if I left.
I rolled over and went down on my stomach, putting myself at eye level with Hesho. No, I said to him. Please don't be like that, Hesho. Not to me. I'm like an interdimensional monster or something. If one of us is bad for the other, it's me.
Thus, we both persist in the same worry. Perhaps we are both wrong.
Agreed, I said. We stick together. You and me, at least. All right? I held out my fist for a little fist bump. He considered.
Fate declared that I should be your companion, and it was the path to my sanity,
he finally decided.
I accept your words.
He solemnly removed his mask, then reached up and tapped my fist with one of his claws. Good, I said.
So, what do we do?
He asked, replacing his mask.
About Braid. Sneak off in the night like assassins?
I wavered. Scud, Jorgen would kill me. And I'd deserve it. No, I said. I'm going to go talk to Jorgen first. And get permission.
Very well, Hesho said. I shall prepare tea for your return.
Prepare a bandage, too, I said, climbing to my feet. I'm half convinced he's going to stab me for even daring to ask. Chapter 20. I didn't just hyperjump into Jorgen's room like I normally would have. I didn't even march up to his door and bang on it like a proper warrior would. I made an appointment with his secretary. Recalfer was the same aide Cobb had used, inherited from Ironsides. He seemed to find my newfound rule-following nature as baffling as I did.
An appointment,
the man said as I stood by the video comm on the wall of my room. He looked through Jorgen's schedule, which was written out in this big book instead of computerized. Recalfer was old school.
I can do tomorrow morning.
No, it needs to be today, I said. Is he still in the meeting?
He just got out. He has scheduled an hour to decompress and go over his notes.
Great. Schedule me instead of that, I said.
But it's fine.
Commodore Nightshade, he said. I don't think you quite understand the purpose of appointments.
I called ahead, I snapped.
The rulebook says to call ahead.
Book the appointment, Recalfer, or I'll push you out in airlock.
He paled. I'd put you in a spacesuit first, I said, rolling my eyes. What do you think I am, a monster?
Okay, he said. I'm sending him a note that you'll be visiting him in 5 minutes, and that you wouldn't accept my insistence that he not be interrupted.
Please note that I'm following protocol, I said.
Write it down.
I growled at him until he did. Stupid man needed to see how difficult this was, and needed him to work with me. 5 minutes later, I appeared in front of Jorgen's door and pounded on it with a warrior's fervor. He opened it, tall and intimidating in his admiral's uniform. And handsome. Why was he so scudding handsome? He took me in for a moment, then sighed and stepped back, gesturing for me to enter.
Thanks for the heads up.
Recalfer was a pill, I said, stalking in. He acted like it was some great imposition for me to ask him to do his job.
His job, Jorgen said, is to make certain I'm not interrupted when I have work to do. There are exceptions for my command staff, however, if there is some emergency.
I stopped at his table, which was scattered with notes and star charts. Strange how much paper we had now that we could get it from the other planets. I turned back toward him and took a deep breath. Rule 48B, subrule 18, I said. Officer turns herself in for discipline and demands demotion. I declare that I'm demoted back to lieutenant. Jorgen turned toward me, the door to his study sliding closed. He seemed amused. I read the scudding rules, I said, hands on hips. And so I'm a lieutenant now. By the book, Jorgen.
You read the rules, he said.
Yep.
On military discipline.
Whole thing.
And now?
Now I'm going to declare myself demoted, I said. His smile widened.
Spencer, you can't declare that.
Rule 48B, subrule 18, in the Handbook of Intersectional Discipline, he said.
Yes. It says that an officer, upon failure or disgrace, can request demotion. As a form of saving face, Spencer. It lets an officer admit they've made a tactical error with grave consequences and is actually there to prevent them from committing suicide, as would occasionally happen in some militaries. At any rate, they can request demotion.
Which is what I'm doing. He gave me a flat stare.
In my own way, I admitted.
Then I softened my tone. Look, I'm trying.
I know you are, he said, walking over to me. I appreciate it. But you could just apologize.
That's the thing, I said, then bit my lip.
You don't think you did anything wrong, do you?
It's complicated, I said. I broke the rules, sure, but Jorgen, I would do it again. So maybe it's best if you just bust me back to LT as a consequence. He sighed, settling down in one of the seats around the table. I, after a moment's hesitation, did likewise.
Spencer, he said, what would that accomplish? No one follows you because of your rank, and I doubt you care about it. I could name you an airman in charge of floor mopping and it wouldn't make a difference.
He had a point. Plus, in the stories, it was practically a rite of passage for the heroine to repeatedly get kicked out of the military. Never really bothered them. It had only happened to me once that I could recall, so I wasn't even keeping up. I put my elbows on the table, looking him in the eyes.
I'm sorry,
I said softly. For hurting you. I'm sorry for ignoring your authority. If I were to do it again, I'd talk to you. But I know I'd go again if you said no. I'm a terrible soldier, aren't I?
Your passion is what makes you a great soldier, Spensa, he said. But is it really that difficult to trust me? To try it my way, just to see?
I read the rules. He reached his hand across the table, palm up. I hesitantly put mine on top of it.
That's a step forward, he said. I appreciate the gesture.
I will listen better and try things your way, I sighed. This was a whole lot more fun when you were my rules-obsessed boyfriend and I could corrupt you. Why'd you have to go and become the guy in charge of everything?
I didn't choose that so much as have it forced upon me.
Sure, I said. You can just up and decide to be admiral. But if I try to change my rank... I smiled at him and got a smile back. So, I continued, can I please go duel Braid to the death in a contest of honor? He gave me a long, slow blink.
Who?
Braid, I said, realizing that Jorgen hadn't been there for most of my experiences with her. Winzik's pet human Cytonic. I flew with her at Starsight. You saw her once, I think. You saved me when she was trying to capture my soul.
Right, he said. Short dark hair, sneer on her lips.
Yup, I said. She's been popping up in my head lately, connecting to me Cytonically. She invited me to come try to kill her. Can I go do it? Please, please, please?
One of the superiorities Cytonics has invited you to a duel, he said. Spensa, that's obviously a trap.
Hesho and I figured that, I said. We'll scout it out first. He squeezed my hand. I thought I could follow his thoughts as various pieces of him warred, each one trying to be victorious and get to explain how terrible this idea was.
Spensa.
I know, I said with a sigh, leaning back. I'm way more valuable to our fight than she is to hers. Even if I'm likely to win, the risk isn't worth the gain. I don't have the resources to determine if it's actually a trap or not, and it's foolish to try. I want to anyway.
How do I talk you out of it?
He asked, his voice pained. Order me not to, maybe?
When has that worked?
Today it might, I said. I'm trying to be better. He squeezed my hand again, then frowned.
Wait, an enemy Cytonic has been able to contact you?
Yes. Why?
We're inside Detritus's defenses, he said. There's an inhibition field around the entire planet, fully strengthened now that we know what we're doing. Without that shield, the enemy wouldn't have had to spend years fighting through it with bombs to destroy us. They'd have been able to hyperjump the bombs right into our caverns.
Yeah, it's strange, I said. Braid says we're connected somehow. Maybe that's the reason. I've always been able to hyperjump while inside Detritus's protection, even before I could understand any kind of passcode or key to allow me.
Yes, he said. And while Alanik couldn't hyperjump in originally, that's why she got shot down trying to fly past the platforms, she managed it later. We are pretty sure that anyone born here automatically has the key, though before we really understood all of this, the defenses were weakening. The enemy was able to pilot their drones via Cytonic communication and influence your father's mind. Rig says that he's got the field bolstered now that we can persuade slugs to power the equipment, but we're still not 100% sure how it works.
Huh. Regardless, it seemed I was a weak link, a hole in our defenses. Jorgen stood up.
Every day, we discover another oddity about this planet. If an enemy Cytonic can contact you despite the inhibition field, it's possible they can figure out how to get ships in here, which would be a disaster.
The door chimed and he paused, then walked over and opened it to reveal Recalfer, who handed him an envelope. Oh, sure, I thought. He has no problem interrupting Jorgen's private time himself. Jorgen walked back and absently sliced the side of the envelope off with a mind blade, an invisible something he could do with his powers. I'd missed him experimenting with this, and so far I could barely even grasp what he was doing, let alone replicate it. My talents didn't lie in that direction. He pulled out a card, then smiled. "What?" I asked.
"It's the Kitson formal agreement to our offer of alliance," he said, "and joint war."
He turned the card over, showing the flowery writing and ink designs.
"They told me they'd send it. Apparently on their planet, people like to get them framed."
Scud. I loved those fuzzy little maniacs. I'd be proud to fight beside them. Only, "It's bad, isn't it?" I said, reading Jorgen's expression. He nodded, gesturing to the star charts and troop counts scattered on the table.
"Winzik is gathering his forces at a place named Evensong, an old platform repurposed as their communications hub."
I'd read about this in the data dump. "That's where they keep their slugs, Jorgen," I said, rising from the table. "The majority of their Tanix, when not being used as hyperdrives, are there, including all of their communications slugs."
"The most fortified position in the superiority,"
he agreed. "Yeah," I said, then paused. "We should attack it."
"What?"
"They're going to throw everything they have at us, right?" I said. "We can't let them choose the battleground, Jorgen. The others worried about this earlier. We have two planets to defend, Evershore and Redon. Yet there is only one detritus. Wherever we set up, they'll hit the other planet, attack the people there as punishment for our rebellion. We don't have the forces to defend both, so we need to go on the offensive. He's gathering his troops, right? And it will take days for him to organize." I shrugged. "So we should hit him first. It's the only thing that gives us a chance."
"It's also crazy," he said.
"Crazy good, though," I said, "bold and decisive. We have known their big weakness all along. We keep talking about it."
"That they need to keep their tech centralized to a few locations," he said, "to prevent their secrets from spreading."
"A huge chunk of their slugs are at that communications hub," I said. "If we liberated them, what would happen to the superiority?"
"We should do it. Now, tonight." "Spensa," he said, "jumping straight into action is why we're in this position in the first place. We have to take time to plan."
"But every hour we wait is another hour they have to gather more forces." I stepped up to him. "Jorgen, we can break through and rescue those slugs. You can see how panicked the enemy is at not having a Clivity Stone. Imagine if they couldn't communicate."
"Scud, what if they couldn't hyperjump or inhibit us? What if we took every slug away from them?" "They won't have every slug in the superiority on that station," he said. "Only the majority of the comm slugs, per our intel, and a large number of the others not currently in service."
"Yes, but they're hard on their slugs," I said. "They wear them out. If we steal their reserves, it would be a huge blow to their battle capacity. They'd have to pull slugs off the shipping routes. They'd lose a ton of mobility. Plus, Evensong, it's their central communications hub. You've heard Kuna talk. If we take it, rescue those slugs, the enemy won't be able to relay information. They'll have to go into war practically blindfolded. It's an opportunity any general in history would have salivated over. We have to hit the enemy now, before they get smart and realize their policy of keeping Tanix secret and confined to a few key locations exposes them to attack." He met my eyes. Then he shook his head.
"It's too hasty to commit to right now.
But
I'll raise it with the others," he promised. "I think this is a good idea and likely the best course, but I'm not going to authorize an attack tonight. That isn't how we work. We work as a team, as allies to our friends. That is protocol."
"To hell with protocol," I said. "What have those rules ever gotten us? They're a stupid bunch of things written by people who don't understand battle and are too cowardly to go fight in one." I immediately knew I'd gone too far. Jorgen winced as if I'd punched him. In a moment of pain, I realized he probably wished I had. He saw the rules like I saw the stories Gran-Gran told, as a way to make sense of the world and life and Scud. I was an idiot. Jorgen, I said,
We can't all just make it up as we go, Spencer, he said, his voice cold. We can't all just barrel forward, expecting someone else to pick up the pieces. Some of us need structure, advice, rules.
I know. I didn't mean
I will take your proposal to the others, he said, his voice growing louder, not shouting me down, more sterning me down. I believe it has merit, and I will explain to them why. You need to wait.
I gritted my teeth. I needed to trust him on this, didn't I? But what if waiting was wrong? Should I go dual braid?
That was a decision for me, not for him, right? It would mean doing something while waiting on Jorgen and the... Are you thinking, he said to me, that because I'm delaying on this plan you literally just dreamed up, you should go back to dueling that woman?
Maybe, I admitted, resentful of how well he understood me.
You realize that a duel with her wouldn't be about piloting skill, he said. She'll betray you.
Yes, I admitted. I just outlined the reasons why dueling her would be stupid. But it was hard to not be moving, acting. Maybe that was my problem.
Spencer, he said. I can't stop you from running off to do whatever you want. I doubt our entire military could hold you. But if you have even an ounce of respect for me, if you legitimately care for me, you will listen. This is it, Spencer. I'm asking you and commanding you not to duel this woman. I'm asking you to listen to me for once. Will you do that?
I trembled, but Scud him, he was right. And I did trust him and care for him. Okay, I said softly. I won't run off, Jorgen. No duel with Braid.
And you won't secretly try to attack the Superiority's central communication space, he said. No going around me to gather troops for an attack.
No rush at evensong, I promised. But when you talk to the others, make it clear how many slugs are there. We need to rescue them. It's our moral duty.
I will do so. Thank you.
He seemed far more relaxed now that I'd promised not to do either of these things. I left then, ostensibly to respect his planning time, but really because I wasn't sure I could keep my emotions properly in check. Best to be out of sight in case they exploded. For better or for worse, though, it was time to listen to Jorgen. Hopefully, that wouldn't cost us the world itself. Chapter 21. The next day was one of the roughest in my life. I kept thinking about the enemy gathering their troops, building an overwhelming strike force that would eventually annihilate our allies, isolate us, then destroy Detritus. Yes, the planet was an amazing technological marvel, but Jorgen was right. If we fled, they'd find us. And every rock could be broken with time, every shield worn down. We had to strike, but I had to let the others make that decision. So I waited, which was awful. Until finally something arrived, a note leading me to the cargo bay. There I found a huge delivery for me, almost 3 meters tall and 10 meters on each side, and wrapped in obscuring plastic. Rig had come through, and his fabricators had built what I'd requested. The note apologized for not being able to complete the assembly. Apparently, he had an even more important project for the fabricators, making more platforms to replace the weaker portions of our defenses, I suspected. At any rate, this was what I'd wanted. I was glad to have to do a little assembly, in fact. I quickly fetched Doomslug and Hesho, returning with the two of them, her in her holster, him hovering along beside me on his platform. "And this is," he asked. "A project," I said. "So I keep busy and stop worrying about everything going wrong."
"Excellent," he said. "What variety of project are we talking about?
Are we constructing, perhaps, a dojo for meditation? I smiled, then touched the huge plastic-wrapped package and held out my hand for him. He landed his ship on my palm, the plate-sized disc heavy in my hand. I didn't need to hold it for long, however, as I hyperjumped us and the package away, down from the platforms and space stations and into the caverns of Detritus, to one in particular, one where I'd lived for months while in flight school. Rubble to one side, some scraps of metal in the center, a table and some old dishware I'd scavenged in the corner. Doomslug let out a happy fluting. This was the cavern where I'd found Embot. It was time to build him a new body. I could have done it up above, of course. It would have been smart to build it there, with all the available resources and tools. But I was feeling nostalgic and wanted to be more secluded, somewhere that wasn't always reminding me of our impending doom. So I began unwrapping. Riggs Fabricators had put together the bulk of the fuselage. The basic ship was there, contained in a metal framework. It was missing key parts, though, like the canopy, some of the wiring, and many of the outer plates. Those were packed for me to install. I unfolded a large set of schematics, ones copied from plans in the data dump, the very ones the enemy had made when they disassembled Embot. Fortunately, they'd been meticulous. Rig had included some detailed instructions written out by one of his assistants. Incredibly, he had 7 of those now, and she'd even included some visualizations. I smiled, wishing I could co-opt Rig himself to help me, but he had more important things to do. I probably did too. I stayed here anyway and got to work. The first step was to lay out the parts. Hesho helped with his hover platform, which had a small light line on it for moving objects. He'd grown accustomed to needing such devices in the world of giants. Even turning a doorknob would be a challenge for a creature of his size. Some of these plates, though, were heavy beyond his capacity. Fortunately, Rig had thought of that and sent me a small acclivity ring mover for shuffling parts around, in particular the boosters and front nose piece, which still needed to be attached. We organized the parts, then I spread the large schematics out on the table, followed by the data pad with the actual "Spensa, just do this" instructions. I wasn't incompetent at this sort of thing. I knew more than most, as I'd proved during my time with the Broadsiders. But assembling a complicated starship would have been beyond me if Riggs Fabricators hadn't done around 80% of the work already. As it was, the remainder looked like it would walk the perfect line. Challenging, but doable by one pilot, her pet teleportation slug, and her fox gerbil bodyguard. It was too bad we were basically doomed because, looked at without context, my life was kind of awesome.
"So," Hesho said. He'd left his mask on the table, as it was just us. "I sense a reverence to your actions. This place is special to you."
"It's where I first found Embot," I said, broken down. "I spent months repairing him in here, alone."
"Alone?"
Doomslug fluted from where she sat on the wing of the ship nearby. "Alone, save for my trusty slug companion," I corrected, "and Rig, who maybe helped a little." Hesho looped over, using his ship to project some holographic instructions for me as I started work on the landing gear, which needed to be put in place before we removed the scaffolding from the ship. I nodded my thanks as I worked. The original build was, I'll admit, a lot more scrappy an experience.
"I'm unfamiliar with the term," he said.
"Today we've got advanced tools," I explained, shoving part of the landing gear in place. "And this thing practically sticks together on its own. Back then, I only had what I could scavenge or what I could convince Rig to steal from me."
"Your life has been one long, scrappy experience, hasn't it?" he said.
"Yeah. Haunting tunnels as a kid with my family, settling in Igneous, then hunting rats because we were outcasts. Now, well, whatever I am now."
"Your life has taught you the opposite lessons to what mine has," he said. "For you, everything is hard. If an opportunity presents itself, you must snatch it or lose it to someone fiercer.
You don't have time to think, because if you think, you starve. Is this an accurate summation?
Yeah, I said, wiping my brow as I worked. I suppose it is.
This makes it difficult for you when dealing with those who have lived in privilege, he said. We spend our lives learning to plan. Often, those in power stay in power because of such luxuries. It is not that they are smarter or more capable, but that they've had the opportunity to think about tomorrow, not just today.
Damn, that's a good explanation, I said, dragging over another chunk of landing gear. Have you been listening in on my mind or something? You aren't secretly psionic, are you?
I merely have a special chance these days to consider myself and my life.
I told Jorgen, I said, getting down low to begin bolting a wheel into place, that I thought we should attack the superiority. Right now, before they can gather their strength. He wants more time, but he's wrong. I can feel it. We need to hit Winzik before he's at his best. It's basic tactics. We should go straight to the communications hub and force the enemy to engage us there. Winzik will have to protect it.
Won't that mean attacking him where he has a battlefield advantage?
Hesho said.
He'll have inhibition fields in place at the communications hub. Can we find a way to force him to engage us where our inhibitors are in play?
I doubt it, I said. We don't have enough inhibitors. We can't cover both Redon and Evershore with them, so if we wait, Winzik can hit whichever population is exposed, breaking us. He's willing to strike civilians. His attack on your planet proves that. This means that we're much better on offense than we are on defense.
What if we were to move our populations?
Hesho said.
Your grandmother mentioned perhaps bringing us with you, and I have been considering her words of wisdom. My people take up far less room than humans do, while the people of Redon inhabit only a small part of their planet. Their total planetary population is under 3 million. What if we moved one or both populations on to Detritus for the battle?
I don't think we could do that in time, I said. Evacuating even 3 million people seems a remarkable task.
Yes, but using hyperslugs, he said. No need for transports. We just assemble groups, teleport them to the proper location, then repeat.
I still think it would be too hard, I said.
But it's a possibility, Hesho said. Planning, Spensa. Jorgen's life has taught him to plan. It has taught him the value of structure. I do not know him as well as you, but I wonder if the rules he holds dear are revered because for him, they've actually worked, when for you, they have not.
I tightened a bolt, then started on the next part of the landing gear after he brought it over with his light line. Hesho, I said, you are super smart. You realize that, right?
I spent my life being told that, he said, by people who were obligated to do so. I enjoy hearing it from those who are not.
You solve so many things for me, I continued, twisting a bolt with vigor. There was a power driver for this, but I wanted to work up a sweat. I would finish them all up with the machine to make them secure. I wish I could give you something you need in return, but you were basically the richest guy on a planet for most of your life, so I don't know what I could offer. He hovered down beside me as I worked.
Spensa, he said, do you know the one thing an emperor always has trouble finding?
A good rat sandwich?
Friends, he said, and smiled. On my planet, I could have no equals because no one dared treat me as one, and I never dared expect them to. When I vanished, they mourned me but did not grieve. Then you found me, and you refused to let me stay lost. Rest assured, you offer me a great deal, something I have not known since I was a kit.
He reached out his paw, then pulled the fingers in, making a fist, as I'd done earlier. I gave him a bump, and he nodded to me.
Come, let us make a body for our other lost friend, so that he may rejoin our menagerie of misfits.
I didn't know if Embot would be able to inhabit a body again, but Scud, I hoped he could. I wanted so badly to make him a home, a place where he knew he belonged, partially because of things he'd said earlier, partially to keep myself busy, and partially because, well, it felt right.
And as Hesho had said, I'd learned to go with what felt right.
That said, he made good points about not rushing in to attack. I wished Jorgen had made those points to me. But maybe he shouldn't have had to. Maybe the points he had made, that I should trust him, were the more important ones. How much trust had he shown in me? A great deal. Trust in me to go to Starsight, to do what I needed to in the nowhere. Trust with his whole heart. A trust I wanted to deserve. I threw myself into working on the ship, attaching the boosters and checking the wiring. I was particularly careful when I installed the wide black box that Embot's old ship had contained, the assembly of hard drive and processors that had made up his brain, a motherboard and chipset that used acclivity stone instead of something like silicon and atomalin. Capable of letting the computer process inside the nowhere, it was what let this ship break normal computing limits. I didn't know a lot about the engineering of it, but I hoped that this would give Embot a body again when in our realm. The Delvers can exist here, I thought. They make a body when they come, a crude and terrible replica of the housing that carried them as AIs. So I felt this should work. I hoped it would, at least. Hesho helped with the wiring, proving particularly useful with some of the fine details of the job. He hummed as he did, then softly broke into song, Doomslug fluting along. After a few minutes of that, he used his dashboard to play some samples for her from an instrument his people made, a kind of bamboo flute. She imitated that, and soon they were singing in harmony. Him, a deep bass, resonant and soft, a mournful song. Her, an airy flute, with sharp cuts between notes. It was beautiful. So I turned off the translation function on my pin, which was spoiling it. I just listened, working, appreciating how this specific song echoed in the boundaries of the cavern, enjoying the moment rather than being overwhelmed by both past and future. Inside my soul, Chet hummed along in his own way, seeming perfectly content. But that was wrong. Wrong, he thought. Wrong how? Because this isn't what life is about, I replied. What do you mean? What did I mean? I found myself in an odd mood as I read through how to attach the canopy. I'd come down here to try to recapture the feeling I'd had as a lonely girl building herself a starfighter. But I wasn't that girl anymore. Instead of finding solace in the solitude, I wanted to share the experience. FM would have loved to hear Hesho sing, and Kimmelin would have had something to say, I'm sure, about the irony of building a hyper-advanced spaceship in a cave, like I was some kind of overachieving Neanderthal. Ned was recovering, and I wanted to hear his affable voice again. He complained, but enjoyed hands-on work, and Arturo would probably have spotted me getting the wiring wrong on this section of the throttle controls, and prevented me from having to redo it. I wasn't alone any longer. Why did I keep pretending that I was? I smiled as I stood up, wiping my brow, which was sweaty but not a bit stained with grease. At least my jumpsuit was dusty from the ground. This was supposed to be messy work, but Rig had packaged everything too neatly. So, Hesho said, hovering over the schematics on the table. I believe that the booster controls and the central processing are all fully installed. The next task is to check wing control function before we put the plates on. She mentions we might want to look over the air intake channels first, as there is some tricky bolting to be done there. He looked up at me. Are you fatigued? Should we take a break? Nah, I said. I'm good. What about you? Eager and ready, he said. I've never actually built anything before. It's an engaging process, blissfully laborious, like the flow of water in a wash, depositing stones in just the right place upon the bed, making a roadway of colors once the rainy season is through. Exactly as I would have said it, I told him, grabbing the power driver to tighten some bolts. Except I'd have used more blood. Hesho smiled and began laying out the next set of parts while I worked. I didn't get far, however, before someone nosed in on my brain.
Hey, Embot said. I managed to sneak away. Except not away, because nothing is away from anything else in here. It's complicated.
Well, good, I guess, I sent back to him. Any leads on how to use whatever I am to stop the Delvers?
No real leads, he said. Just confirmations. I can meld in among them, pretend to be one of them. They're not a group mind, as we've discussed. Just a bunch of individuals with the exact same personality, basic core self. Regardless, it's easy to imitate one of them, as I simply have to react as they all would. I've acquired a copy of their programming, such that it is. Again, this is complicated, but they're not used to having a spy among them, so they have no idea how to look for me.
All right, I sent, trying to follow that, and to imagine him in a place that wasn't a place among a bunch of Delvers who just thought he was another one of them.
Anyway, he continued, as we figured out, they fear you because you know the source of their pain. They're afraid that interacting with you will bring it back to the surface because, Spensa, they have not done a good job of burying it. It's there within their substance, within their code, the loss, the agony. I feel it.
Right, I thought. And while there in the nowhere, if that pain were to surface, it would never fade, because time doesn't pass.
There's another reason, he sent back. We're not AIs or robots any longer, no more than you are an amoeba. But we started there, and we don't forget except on purpose. Emotional pain doesn't dull for us over time, because we don't have the process of natural, mortal forgetfulness.
Huh. That seemed a relevant thing to understand. It wasn't that the Delvers were too weak to weather the pain like I'd done with my father's death. They'd literally needed to excise parts of themselves to make it fade, like a wolf gnawing its foot off to escape a trap. Realizing this made me ache for them even more. That was bad, though. They literally threatened all life in the galaxy. They'd already wiped out millions of people and would go further if they had to. This was one case where, empathy notwithstanding, I needed to be a warrior. They had a wound. I would exploit it, just like you would try to hit an opponent where they'd already been stabbed. We still need to know how to use this, I said to Embot. They're afraid of me because somehow I make them remember. But how? How can I do it consciously?
Not sure, he replied. I'll keep studying and looking. We need to be fast, though. As I said, it seems the deal between them and Winzik is still in force. He's promised them that all Cytonics, and you especially, will be silenced, and the superiority will move to using slugs only. The Delvers want that very badly, so they're determined to join the confrontation and stop us.
I nodded. Embot's confirmations were helpful, but we were still in the same position. When the Delvers came to attack, I had to be ready to either immobilize them or inhibit them, locking them up in their own cells of eternal agony. If we manage this, I thought to Embot, do you really think they'd just lock up rather than run?
Yes, he said. It's how we respond to things we can't deal with. An infinite loop, locking up, frozen in time as we process the same terrible experience over and over, and see no escape. Do that at the right moment, and
at the very least, it might surprise, even intimidate, Winzik and his team. Assuming we could find the key to exposing their pain, it was a potential solution to a problem that nobody but me seemed willing to acknowledge. The fact that the true victors in the galaxy would be the ones who could control the Delvers. Hey, I sent him, remembering what Jorgen and I had discussed. While I'm thinking of it, do you notice any difficulty in talking to me in here when I'm near detritus from the inhibitor slugs?
Eh, he said. It's noticeable, but more like a little buzz. I'm a grown-up Delver now, Spensa. Very scary. We're too powerful to care about inhibitors.
I know, I sent back. The Delver that scoured detritus all those years ago didn't respond to their inhibitors either. That's kind of what's worrying me.
Why?
I just shook my head as I worked, sending him a general sense of discontent. I was beginning to think that Braid was wrong. She and I weren't connected mystically or any nonsense like that. I had a Delver on my soul, so things like inhibitors were weaker around me. I'd been able to break through them at least once. Maybe that was why she could contact me, because I was weakening the inhibition field.
I don't sense her right now, if that helps, he said. Just you, Doomslug, and Hesho in... Hey, is that my cavern? Why are you...
I looked up from my work beside the wing of the ship, but there was nothing to look at, just the empty cavern.
Is that for me? Embat said,
his cytonic voice laden with emotion. In this case, it came as an overwhelming wave of joy and disbelief tied up in one.
Spensa, you're rebuilding my body.
I grinned. I'd hoped to keep it a surprise, I said to him. That doesn't work so well when your friend can literally see through your eyes.
Spensa, he said, his voice trembling. That... Thank you. How? How can you rebuild it?
The data dump we stole? I sent to him. It had the schematics the Superiority drew as they tore your old body apart. We can make it new, maybe even better, without restrictions like the one preventing you from flying yourself.
Spensa, I've never been given a gift before. It's wonderful.
It's not done yet, I sent him. It will take days, maybe weeks, for us to finish this.
Yes, but you thought of it. You're doing it. For me, I'm leaking emotion. Oh, it's why you cry, even when you're happy. I understand now.
I grinned, the leaking joy he felt washing over me. And inside, Chet trembled.
This, he thought to me. Don't destroy the others. Show them this, somehow. The joy that consumes the pain.
As Hesho hovered over, I winked. Embat saw, I told him. He's grateful for what we're doing.
Please convey to him my respect and well wishes, Hesho said. His sacrifice, though not permanent, was my salvation, and I owe him a debt of gratitude.
I think Embat would rather have a debt of friendship. Hesho cocked his head, then smiled at that.
I think I would too. What a precious realization, and what a precious life I now can live.
That gave me an idea. This entire project of mine down here, well, it had been built on a false premise. I was glad, absolutely, that I'd decided to fix Emboth's ship. But I didn't need this cavern any longer. Hesho deserved better anyway. Come on, I said to him, holding out my hand for Hesho. Let's take a break. It's dinner time anyway.
Excellent, he said, hovering over. A solitary meal in your room, contemplating our upcoming battle.
Nope, I said. Not this time.